Hey everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. Jerry's here, and this is Stuff You Should Know.
And look, there's Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
And Edie Sedgwick, and Lou Reed.
Yeah, and Jackie Curtis, and Valerie Solanas. The whole gang's here.
We did one on that, right? And the Scum Manifesto?
Yes, we did. Okay, chapter 18 of our book is on the Scum Manifesto and Valerie Solanas shooting Andy Warhol.
We did not do it as a podcast yet.
No.
Oh, well,
and we
maybe
probably
we
never will.
Oh, okay.
But I think, Chuck, before we get into this, we should dispense something because I think it's very instructive about Andy Warhol. He is probably the most famous quote from him is that in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. And he didn't say that. Yeah. Even in an interview in 1980, he said he didn't say it. He used it in, I think, a 1980 or 68 exhibition, like the notes. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't his. There is at least four other people who can make a claim to having said it first. And that says a lot about Andy Warhol, that he was not shy or embarrassed or even secretive about taking other people's ideas, even asking other people for ideas to use in his own work. And then it also shows that that the idea that he said that and that that's so associated with him and his whole, ethos, it also demonstrates that he himself was one of his own works of art.
Yeah.
His own brand, his own image, his own appearance, everything about him. He was one of his own works of art. And those two things are all captured in just that one little quote.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. A little bit about his childhood before we get to the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was born, actually, Andrew Warhola. He would drop the A years later. He was born, and it's interesting. You think of Warhol as a contemporary artist, which he is in some ways, but he was born in 1928.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, he was a bit older when he was at Studio 54 in the 1970s, older as in like my age.
Even stranger than that, Chuck, he was born in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, well, not stranger if you're from Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is very proud of their Warhol connection, especially to Carnegie Mellon University, where he went. His parents were European immigrants, and his mother was an artist. He was the youngest of three boys, and his parents were very encouraging of his art.
Yeah.
They got him a camera when he was a little kid. They sent him to art classes and eventually would pay for him to go. It was Carnegie Institute of Technology at the time, but Carnegie Mellon now, which is a great art school.
Just
great school, period.
Right. Yeah, it really is. I read that the whole family just kind of, I don't want to say coddled, but he was a bit of the center of attention. He was the center of the family, being the baby of three boys. And when he was a kid, he came down with Sydenham chorea, or chorea, which is also known as St. Vitus dance, which is a really mean name for a neurological disorder where you have involuntary movements.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in bed for a number of months. And he, again, just happened to have a mom who was into art who took that time to teach him to draw.
Yeah.
And then he also spent some of that time reading celebrity magazines. So those two things that he got into in the when he was sick in bed really kind of came together to form the foundation of his whole career.
Yeah. And like you said, he was the youngest. He was also ill. He had a skin discoloration issue. He didn't like his nose. He thought his nose was bulbous and misshapen.
Mm-hmm.
He was bullied at school. He was always very, just always felt bad sort of about the way he looked. And then later in life when he would wear wigs and have plastic surgery and wear makeup and stuff like that, people would say that sort of, you know, was Andy from the time he was young. His father would die when he was just 14 years old of jaundiced liver.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard on young Andrew. He could not go to the funeral. I don't know if that's from emotion.
Yeah, yeah. He was just upset. Completely overwhelmed, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So he was hiding under his bed during the wake. And eventually he would move to New York City in 1949, where he would drop that A and become a very successful commercial illustrator, kind of pretty quickly.
Yeah, he knew how to hustle, too. I read that he would go to record stores and look at album art and then pick out the labels that had the coolest art and then go mm-hmm. to those labels and try to get work from them.
Yeah.
And it worked a lot. And I think it's one of those things where once you make a name for yourself with a couple companies, it gets easier and easier to get work. So he made a pretty good name for himself. He made a pretty good living as a commercial artist for at least the first decade or so of his career. And he had this style that I don't know was unique to him, but, you know, he basically adopted it himself, where he would draw something, usually kind of out of proportion. Some parts were more detailed than others. It very, very early 60s drawing, like almost Pink Panther type
yeah.
illustration. And then he would blot the ink before it was dry. So some parts would be thicker. Some lines would be thicker than other parts that were not even disconnected and almost appeared dotted. And then he would go over and color them in outside of the lines, like almost blot them with paint. And he became really well known for that. And it was really good to apply to women's shoes. And that was one of his favorite things to draw commercial art for.
Yeah, he also started, and this would come in very handy, as we will see when he sort of had his assembly line art thing going at the factory.
Mm-hmm.
He made stamps of things. He made rubber stamps, and this is how he would do printmaking. So if he had a client and was like, I love this, but I don't like the color, he could go do it again without starting all over just by changing the color out on the stamp. Or if he was doing like screen printing or printmaking or something like that,
mm-hmm.
he's very easy to change things up. And like you said, he won awards. He made some pretty good money. He was out as a gay man in the 1950s.
I've seen that he was and that he wasn't.
Oh, really? I've always seen that he was. But either way, it was the art world of the 1950s. Even in that scene, it wasn't the most normal thing to like be out and proud.
Right. For sure. No, definitely. So one of the things that made Andy Warhol is he never really saw the high art that he created, gallery art versus commercial art, as something more elevated than mm-hmm. the commercial artwork he did. It was just different, or maybe he could make more money for it, or there were other people involved. But he viewed the gallery owners, the curators, and people who would eventually commission him or you know buy his work, he would let them help shape it. Like, he wasn't like one of those, you know, the picture of the artistes who like can't
right.
even take the first note about
yeah.
their work.
You get
he
what
would
you
be
get.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, you were his client when you were buying art from him. And that's how he viewed it. And that was definitely new. And he carried that throughout his career. And it had a lot of benefits for him. And then toward the end, it really kind of detracted from his image, as we'll see.
Yeah, for sure. Early on, and this is in the 50s, you got to remember, he was selling some self-published art books. He had one called Studies for a Boy book that was in a gallery called the Bodley Gallery, and it was his first solo exhibition. They were sketches of young men. He was not shy about projecting sexuality in any of his works. And like we said, this is the 1950s. Even in the art world, some people accepted that stuff. Other galleries were like, no, we can't have like gay-themed art in our gallery, even in like a New York art gallery. So he was kind of pushing the envelope early on with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with his mom. His mom lived with him. She moved to New York and lived with him for about 20 years.
Yeah.
Until she left in, I think, 1971,
mm-hmm.
Is where she went home to die, right?
Yeah, essentially. And another, just like with his father, he ignored letters from his cousin telling him, like, his mom was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently she was holding out for him to visit, and he never did. And I don't think he went to her funeral either. And he said later that in a quote that he couldn't bear to think of it. He likened her to a bird that had died recently, mm-hmm. and that he couldn't even bear to think of the bird dying, that he just liked to think that it was out for a walk.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing just totally overwhelmed him. He was very close to his mother. I mean, think about it. He lived with his mother for 20 years.
Yeah.
During like the height of his career and fame. Oh, yeah. And supposedly also they were both deeply religious Byzantine Catholics. And he would carry a rosary around in his pocket with him. But there's a lot of legends and stories about Andy Warhol. There's also another story that he would carry loose diamonds around in his pocket because he liked to just kind of, you know, jiggle them around like they were mm-hmm. loose change. So who knows? It's not entirely documented, but there's a whole thread of there's a whole camp that's like, no, he was super religious. He just kind of hid it.
Yeah, he was a bit of a conundrum mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. The more I read about him, it was interesting because he could be quite kind and giving. He could also be very cruel, even to friends of his, as we'll see. He was a lot of things. He was a well-noted liar. Yeah. So even things that you read that Andy Warhol said oftentimes was not the truth. And the way I took it was he wasn't like, oh, he's a liar. He's a bad guy because he lies. Or it seemed like he just liked messing with people and he would just make stuff up.
Yeah, some people, it's funny because, you know, from the outside, you think of Andy Warhol as almost like an art god. But right. inside the art world, like, there were a lot of people who were just annoyed with him or
oh, sure.
just thought he was lame or a creep. I saw him compared to basically an energy vampire.
Yeah.
But then, like you said, other people are like, no, he was very kindly and very giving of himself and of his money and helped people get like a start for in their art career that they were looking for. Like, Yeah, like you said, he was a contradiction in terms in a lot of ways.
Yeah, big time. So he obviously is most famous for being a pop artist. Pop art started in London in the early 50s, and Warhol was one of the first U.S. artists to kind of get involved in this art movement that emerged from Dada and also just had a lot of, it was just sort of in the early, it was in the zeitgeist of the art scene at the time mm-hmm. of this idea of, mass-produced objects being a theme. There was also, at the same time, though, a very different world of people like Jackson Pollock and abstract expressionism happening, mm-hmm. people who were very serious about their art and mm-hmm. who I imagine did not appreciate this kid. Well, he wasn't a kid by that point, but this guy named Andy Warhol, this very eccentric guy that's, you know, one of the very first things he did were those celebrity screen prints, those silk screens.
Right, yeah. One of the abstract expressionist kings, Willem de Kooning, told Andy Warhol to his face that he was a killer of beauty, a killer of art. He said, you even kill laughter.
Yeah, de Kooning, he killed a lot of laughter too himself.
He was pretty drunk at the time, but
yeah.
I'm sure Andy Warhol didn't like to hear that, right? So so he is associated with pop art, and it definitely did dominate abstract expressionism. And it kind of said like, hey, you don't have to take art quite so seriously. And not only that, are you guys paying attention over here to how commercial and consumerist America's becoming? Let's start mm-hmm. meditating on that a little bit. And like you said, one of the first ones that really kind of gained attention were his silk screens of celebrities like Marilyn Monroe. And I think one of the first ones he did was Marilyn's portrait on a gold background. And it was meant to basically kind of look like a Renaissance icon of uh-huh. the Madonna. Just the gold suggested it, I guess, something like
yeah.
that. And what he was essentially saying, he was equating celebrity as replacing religion now. So it was kind of like comments like that that was the basis of early
right.
pop art.
Should we take a break?
Yeah.
I don't think this has any great cliffhangers.
No, it really doesn't.
I was trying to find one. All right, so we'll take a break now and we'll come back with the sort of the beginning of Andy Warhol's pop art career right after this.
Hey everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website, whether it's an online course or custom merch. Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's Rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 2512928887, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody, we're here to tell you about Viator, a tool that you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world.
That's right. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in.
Yep, Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. 300,000 plus travel experiences to choose from means you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.
That's right. You can also enjoy real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experience that you're considering. Plus, you get free cancellation that helps you plan for the unexpected.
Yeah, and Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. So download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
All right. So we mentioned before the break in 1961, I think one of his first pop art works was called Black and White. It was Black and White. It was called Coca-Cola 2. Mm-hmm. And if you look it up, it's a drawing of one of those great Coke bottles. Mm-hmm. And this would become a thing for him, like brands, especially food and beverages, which is very interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. But he did those silk screens right away. And then the very next year, in 1962, is when those Campbell's soup cans came out. A couple of the things he's most well known for were those celebrity silk screens and the Campbell's soup cans, 32 portraits. And I love that Livia used those in quotes. Use portraits in quotes, because what he did was he would project, is what I did when I was a kid. I had a little overhead projector, and I would project an image of Opus the Penguin or Bill the Cat on a wall, and I would trace it, and I would act like I could draw.
Right.
When I couldn't, I was just tracing something, and that's what he did with those soup cans. He traced them from being projected on a wall.
Yeah, so they were, the first 32 portraits were hand-drawn, his first Campbell's soup one portraits were. And he actually didn't have the idea himself. He paid $50 to a designer named Muriel Letao at a party. He paid by check for the idea. She said she had a good idea, and that was it. And he turned it into his whole career. And then there's one other development, too, while he was doing the Campbell's soup cans that really kind of altered his career, that instead of projecting onto, you know, a canvas and then hand drawing something and then going back and painting it, he figured out that you could take you could project an image onto a silk screen that had emulsion on it that would burn that image onto that silk screen and all of a sudden you had a stencil and you could put whatever color you wanted through it and make the same thing over and over and over again. And so his next series of soup cans were just Campbell's tomato soup, but in all sorts of different colors. And that kicked off the Marilyn, the Elvis, the Jackie, I think 100 ways or something like that. That changed his career because not only did it cause a sensation, like nobody had made art like that before and it looked really cool, but also it allowed him to form the assembly line that he eventually became famous for.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of his art later on was done by these people that worked for him in the factory. And it was you know, if you've ever been to like a t-shirt silkscreen place and there's people just like silkscreen t-shirts one after the other, mm-hmm. Andy Warhol was doing that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and becoming very famous for it. It's very interesting how it all happened. But there was a gallery in 1962, the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles, where he had his first solo pop art exhibition of these soup cans. The gallery co-owner was named Irving Bloom, and he displayed them like they were cans on a shelf, mm-hmm. Like at a supermarket. Very clever. Dennis Hopper very famously bought one of those first ones. But apparently, Warhol didn't even go. A lot of people didn't go. Wasn't super big at first.
It was mocked, right?
Yeah, a lot of writers were making fun of it in the press. One quote was like, frankly, the cream of asparagus does nothing for me, but the terrifying intensity of the chicken noodle gives me a real zen feeling. So he was being mocked until, you know, he became Andy Warhol. I mean, I'm sure he was mocked for a lot of his career, mm-hmm. by some of those same critics that had their nose turned up at stuff like this.
For sure.
But it was the beginning of this movement in the United States, and no one had ever seen anything like it.
No, because nobody had done anything like it. Like you said, commercialism had kind of slipped in here or there, but this was nothing but commercialism and a comment on commercialism and our relationship to brands and all that kind of stuff. And that was definitely new. And from that, the pop art aesthetic like took off. You can basically plant that at the feet of Andy Warhol in his first Campbell's soup can portraits. And then very quickly after that, later on, the tomato soup portraits with silk screening. And today, I think what happened was, did you say Blum, Irving Blum?
I said Bloom, but...
Bloom. He.
It may be Blum.
Either way. He decided that those portraits should not be sold off individually. They didn't really make sense on their own. They made sense as a group because it was allegedly all 32 flavors of Campbell's soup. And that, you know, just having scotch broth by itself is kind of cool, but not really. You need the whole thing. So he bought back, including Dennis Hopper's, he bought back all of those first 32 portraits, and he paid Andy Warhol $1,000. About $10,000. One.
Today, right.
Yeah. Hand-drawn or hand-painted soup can. It was called a small torn soup can pepper pot. In 2006, that one sold for $11.8 million. So Irving Blum got these things for a song because it hadn't taken off yet, but it did very quickly after that.
Well, that small torn Campbell soup can, that wasn't even one of the big paintings. Yeah. That was paper dresses. We talked about paper dresses were a thing at the time, literally dresses made out of these like paper pieces. And he was making these paper dresses with images silk screened on them. And Campbell's soup even started doing that later on. But just one of the pictures from one of the dresses sold for almost $12 million.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I also saw too, I don't understand art unless somebody explains it to me.
Same here.
But I saw that especially the silkscreen tomato soup cans, that is the same soup can but in a bunch of different colors, mm-hmm. that what he's doing is by taking this thing that you take as a given that's so familiar, it's a Campbell soup can, I recognize it, everybody knows what that is. And by playing with the colors and making different color combinations, he was actually like basically melting the brand. The whole idea of the brand, the whole identity of the brand was just kind of being stripped away from the viewer's brain and turned into something else without the viewer even really realizing it, because the colors were so pretty that you just kind of lost track that you're looking at a soup can, even though you start out knowing that you're looking at a soup can.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting too.
Yeah. As far as pop art goes, you know, you mentioned a comment on consumerism. You know, it sort of depends on who you ask on what it means. That can be a comment on consumerism. Mm-hmm. It could be just, you know, everyday things are like celebrating something that's everyday and ordinary. Andy Warhol himself said pop art is just about liking things, and that he ate Campbell's soup every day for lunch for 20 years. Right. I don't know if that's true. That sounds like one of his little stories that he might tell. But for him, it was very simple. I don't think he tried to get too overly analytical about it. He was just like, it's pop art. And that's the whole point, is you shouldn't examine it too closely.
Well, one of the other things, though, is that he was very ambitious. He liked money. He liked fame. He wanted to be known as the greatest artist in the world. And he was like, he was a consumer himself. Like, he liked stuff. He liked spending money on things, like that story about him walking around with loose diamonds in his pocket. So it's weird. He liked the very stuff that his paintings allegedly criticized or made fun of or mocked or analyzed. He was into that same scene. He mm-hmm. wasn't an outsider to it. He was as much an American consumer as anybody else. And that was very odd for that time. You know, that was the time where, like, you didn't want to be a sellout or anything like that. Andy Warhol was a sellout from the very beginning. He even put a fake ad in the Village Voice saying, like, he would attach his name to the following things if you would pay him for it. And it was a joke, but at the same time, it wasn't a joke, as we'll see. He started making what he called business art and started making a lot of money from it. And as a result of his taking that up very quickly, becoming like basically a sellout as soon as he could, the art critics basically say his period of actual good artwork just lasted from 1961 with the Coca-Cola bottles to the 1964 Flowers edition. So 3 years.
Interesting.
Even though his career kept going on, that was his last notable painting. Specifically, there's an art critic for the Washington Post named Blake Gopnik, who wrote a 900-page biography on Andy Warhol and his art. And I don't think it was just his opinion. I think that's generally the art critic world's opinion, that he was almost a flash in the pan as far as actually producing good art is concerned.
Well, yeah. I mean, what he was he kind of was the art. He created a brand and a persona that was bigger than the art itself. So it was... Yeah, I mean, you talk about separating art from artists. It was indistinguishable in Andy Warhol's case. It was all a part of who he was, he was the Campbell soup can, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, we take it for granted today, living decades into the postmodern era and now decades into the era of influencers and Instagram. Like, that's a normal thought to us.
Right, totally.
This guy was doing this when modernism still reigned and postmodernism was just starting to bleed out of it, where there weren't such things as influencers. Like, maybe he did. He might have invented it. At the very least, he gave other people, a lot of other people, the idea to try the same things.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to talk about his filmmaking, because he would branch out away from, screen printing things, although he did that kind of throughout, I think, because he had his factory going. But in the mid-60s, he started to make visual art. In 63, his first film, Sleep, I was about to say came out, but it kind of didn't really. I'm sure it played in some avant-garde theaters here and there. But his movies were, they weren't movies. They didn't have plots and characters and three-act structure and stuff like that. He would sit a camera up in front of the Empire State Building and shoot it for 8 hours. Sleep was 5 hours and 21 minutes of his boyfriend, John Giorno, sleeping. His most successful movie, if you want to call it that, was called The Chelsea Girls in 66. I love Olivia says it came at a relatively snappy 3 hours.
Well, what's funny is it came in at 3 hours because it was a six-hour movie that he split in half and projected side by side next to each other. So technically it was 6 hours.
It was 6 hours. But this also didn't have a plot. He was very explicit with his real sex in movies without it being, I'm sure a lot of people labeled it pornography at the time, but it was art.
Also drug use, too.
Oh, Sure. Like he was very open and explicit about all of this at, like I mentioned, the factory. He had three places called the factory, mm-hmm. and they were his art studios, they were his meeting places, his party spaces, the first one being at East 47th in 1964.
Yeah, that was the Silver Factory. An artist named Billy Name. And Name is not his real last name. He just adopted it. It's kind of like generic. I love that.
Yeah.
He covered it in aluminum foil and silver paint, which gave it the name Silver Factory, but it was also a former hat factory. A fat factory is another way to put it. And the other reason factory applies is because, remember, Andy Warhol was the one who came up with assembly line art.
Yeah.
He would have an idea, or maybe somebody would give him an idea. He would execute it initially, like maybe create the first stencil, make a couple versions of it with different color combinations, and then after that, he would basically leave it to his assistants to start producing his art that he would sign. It was his art, but that was a brand new way of considering art. And so much so that he had an assistant, a guy who basically became his right hand. His name was Gerard Malanga, or Malanga, as we'll see. He would go to interviews with Andy Warhol, and Warhol would be like, why don't you ask my assistant Jerry here some questions? He did a lot of my paintings. And I think most people at the time thought he was kidding. And he wasn't kidding at all. Like, not just Jerry, but other people were physically making the paintings that he was selling for tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and to be clear, I know people are typing up emails right now. This is not a new idea, and this is not something that doesn't happen all the time in the art world. There are, in fact, we got an email from someone recently who was called a ghost artist, like a ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. They, very famous artists, many, many times have assistants that actually pump out these paintings in their style mm-hmm. and sell them.
Wow.
It's always happened. I had a friend who 25 years ago did it for a guy here in Atlanta, mm-hmm. and now she's her own artist and has her own gallery, which is great.
Oh, great.
But that's how an assistant a lot of times can get their foot in the door, is by working for a very famous artist who has other people paint their art. It's okay. Just, it happens
so,
all the time.
All right, then, if he didn't invent it, he was the one who made no secret of it whatsoever. He exposed it and actually used it to his benefit.
Well, and his had definitely more of a assembly line feel than the others. It's not like other ghost artists, like, I'll paint the trees and then you slide it to the next person who paints the mountain. Mm-hmm. It's like a single artist sort of recreating the pieces of art, or a team of six assistants that are all working on their individual thing.
Right.
It's not like a factory kind of thing that Andy Warhol did. So it was a little different.
So initially his assistants were basically, this is going to sound unkind. They were very heavy drug users, if not addicted to drugs.
Yeah.
They were very frequently street kids.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them had been kicked out of their houses because they were transgender or they were gay. They were society's cast off and
yeah.
weirdos. And he collected them like they were precious memory figurines and surrounded himself with them.
Yeah. And that included, he collected all kinds of people. He collected them. The factory was a scene, man. It was like, you could have some, 17-year-old street kid who was a junkie sitting next to a very famous, actor, like a Dennis Hopper or a real musician. And of course, the Velvet Underground was never that big in the United States. That's kind of what they're famous for these days, is America not ever really accepting them. They were huge in Europe.
Uh-huh.
But the Velvet Underground was had a thing going in New York. Andy Warhol was their first manager. He financed that first great record and brought in Nico to sing on it. He designed that great album cover with a banana. And that was part of the scene. The Velvet Underground was hanging out there at the factory. Dennis Hopper's hanging out at the factory. People are coming and going. They're doing heroin. They're having sex out in front of everyone.
Shooting a lot of speed, too. That was a big one.
Lots of speed. It was wild.
It was super wild. Like, people would just walk around naked. Like, it was nuts. Totally unhinged. Like, there were very few rules or regulations or anything like that. I think it was just one of those things where if you got in and you could manage to stay in, you could do basically whatever you wanted. And I also get the idea that people performed. Like, it was performative, too. That it was also very competitive, because
yes.
one of the things that he was known to do was to just really latch onto somebody and find them very interesting, and mm-hmm. then he would get bored with them and just kind of leave them behind in the dust.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the reasons why he was called, I think it was Fran Lebowitz who said that, who called him a vampire. Mm-hmm. He would not just kind of take energy from people, he would also take talent from people. Apparently he had a talent for recognizing the peculiar talents that each individual person has and then using them for himself.
Yeah.
So, for example, I think one of his assistants named Bob Colicello. Andy Warhol had a terrible memory, but he liked to record everything with his tape recorder so he could remember. Not everybody wanted him to use his tape recorder. And Bob Colicello, he found out, had a really great memory. So Bob Colicello was his human tape recorder when somebody wouldn't let him record their conversation. Just stuff like that. Just random stuff like that. And he assembled his life the way he wanted it, using the people he surrounded himself with, and then just kind of interchanging them like they were Tetris parts when he saw fit.
Yeah. There was an author and a performer named Bridget Berlin, who was around in the 60s and 70s at the factory. She hopped up on speed. She would do all kinds of work. She sometimes would run the factory line. Sometimes she would get a hold of his diaries and edit his diaries. Sometimes she would co-write his books. Edie Sedgwick, probably one of the biggest of his, what he called the superstars, as far as, you know, name recognition. Mm-hmm. She was a very pretty young woman, very troubled. She was from a very prominent family. They met in 1965 when she was 21 and he was 36. She went on to be in 10 of those movies of his. And they were inseparable at a certain point. They would match outfits. She was always on his arm. But when you talk to insiders, they would say that, you know, he treated Edie very badly at times. And at one point he said, "Do you think Edie will let us film her when she commits suicide?" So it was that kind of thing that happened. She very sadly died of a drug overdose when she was 28 years old. So just 7 years into their relationship.
Yeah. I've also seen it pointed out that, there was a habit of people, around him dying young, and that's not the case with everybody. Like Bridget Berlin was shown shooting up speed in Chelsea Girls. And I think she lived to 2020. So people could make it out of his orbit, alive. But other people like Edie Sedgwick didn't, and some people blame Andy Warhol for encouraging just that kind of behavior, people's self-destructive behavior, either for his own amusement or whatever he was getting out of it.
I think that cult song, Edie, was about Edie Sedgwick.
Yeah, she was supposedly the first it girl, where whatever she did started a nationwide trend among people mm-hmm. who were into fashion or style or whatever. Like, she couldn't. Whatever she did, it was just it. She had her own thing, and everybody put her up on this pedestal. And she was a bright, brilliant star.
Yeah. Candy Darling was another one of his cohorts for a while. And if you look up Candy Darling, like, I didn't even know a ton about Warhol, a little bit here and there. But when I looked up Candy Darling, I was like, oh, I've seen this person mm-hmm. in pictures. Mm-hmm. Like, my whole life, I feel like. Candy Darling was a transgender woman. Got hormone therapy at a time when that wasn't something that people did or was even very easy to get done. And also Jackie Curtis was friends with Candy Darling, and they were kind of a pair with Warhol. And Jackie Curtis was a playwright and a poet and a singer, and was back in the 1960s playing with gender identity and using different pronouns and using terms like, you know, fluidity and things like that. This is at a time where, like, no one was doing this kind of thing, and that's what Jackie Curtis is doing.
Yes. Another very famous superstar. I don't know if we said or not, he would call them superstars, the people who were around him and starred in his movies and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well done, Chuck. Another superstar is a guy named Robert Olivio, who was known as Undine. Is that how you'd say it?
I don't know if it was Undine or Undine, but Undine sounds more right.
I think so, too. He met Andy Warhol at a really chic party. No, I'm sorry. He met Andy Warhol at an orgy in the early 60s. And Undine did not like Andy Warhol from the get-go, because Andy Warhol was just standing there watching everybody, not participating, basically. And Undine didn't like that at all. So he had his friend, whose orgy it was, throw Andy Warhol out. And they crossed paths again later and I guess hugged it out, and Undine became one of his favorite people.
Yeah. I mean, there's a, if you look up Andy Warhol superstars, there's a very, very long list of people. We obviously can't go over all of them, but we should mention Joe D'Alessandro. He was the one of the more famous, at least in that scene. One of the actors in many of his films, and just a sort of a gay subculture sex symbol icon for, you know, a couple of decades, and I think is still around.
He was also the model for the Rolling Stones Sticky Fingers cover.
Oh, is that D'Alessandro?
Yeah, that cover of just basically a man's crotch in jeans.
That was his crotch.
pretty tight jeans, too.
They're very tight.
Do you want to take a break and then come back and talk about who shot Andy Warhol?
Yeah, it was Lily Taylor right after this.
Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's Rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 25129288 87, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Sip the sky.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
So nice reference, Chuck, to I Shot Andy Warhol, the movie, which I think contains the Yola Tango song I Shot Andy Warhol, right? Isn't that for that movie?
Probably. I don't remember. It's been a while.
That's a great song.
It's got to be.
Yeah. Let's go listen to that song. It's very good. So Valerie Solanas is who Lily Taylor was playing in that movie, I Shot Andy Warhol. And she was, again, if you have our book, go read chapter 18. It goes
Not the kid's book.
No, it wasn't in the kid's book.
No.
It goes way into detail about Valerie Solanas and the shooting. But in the abbreviated version, is she was a radical feminist, a playwright, a man-hater. And I say that quite confidently because she was the founder and sole member of the Society for Cutting Up Men, SCUM, uh-huh. Author of the SCUM Manifesto, which is definitely worth reading. I think I've mentioned before on the show. And she had a beef with Warhol. She wrote a play called Up Your Ass, and she wanted Warhol to produce it. And not only would he not produce it, he lost the manuscript that she gave him, or the script that she gave him. And that really enraged her. And apparently the Andy Warhol Foundation and Museum in Pittsburgh has that script still. They keep it under lock and key. But yeah. She never got it back, essentially. And then he also used some of her recorded words without credit in one of his movies. So she did not like Andy Warhol. She was kind of fixated on him. And on June 3rd, 1968, she shot him.
Up Your Ass is so funny.
Oh, and there's like so many like subtitles to it too, but you can just call it Up Your Ass.
I haven't seen that in a long, long time. I saw that movie back when it came out, and Lily Taylor was so good. I love her, and she's amazing in that role. But yeah, on June 3rd, 1968, she went to the apartment of another sort of art scene lady named Margot Fiden, and said was, you know, really pretty out of it. She suffered from schizophrenia, so she was not having a good day. She was still trying to get this play made and was almost begging this woman, Margot, to do that. And she said, you know, that she couldn't do that. And she said, oh, yes, you will, because I'm going to shoot Andy Warhol, showed off her gun, and left. And apparently Fiden tried to warn Warhol, wasn't able to get to him. This is when the factory was now at Union Square,
mm-hmm.
and she shot him and did not immediately kill him. We'll hold on to that till the end, but he was really messed up. He got a lot of had a lot of damage to his internal organs, had many surgeries, a lot of scarring, and had to wear a corset for the rest of his life because of these injuries.
A medical corset that held his guts in, essentially.
Yeah.
I saw that when he was recuperating in the hospital, he said to somebody, you know, we got to get some bigger things to hide behind. Isn't that great?
Very Andy Warhol.
So he did survive, but he was different after that. And some people argue that he was already headed in this direction. But basically, he stopped hanging out with the people living on the fringes of society, entered society. Like high society, he took his rightful place there as like a beloved art god among people who could pay millions of dollars for paintings.
Yeah.
Got a really nice house, got a Rolls Royce. And then the next factory that he set up was like a legit business. And he started making what he called business art, where if you were very wealthy, you could have him paint you in the style of Marilyn or Elvis, that kind of silkscreen thing. And he would take your money and be totally fine with it. And he became, again, such a sellout, there's really no other way to put it, that even those portraits started to become bad. Like, he didn't even pay that much attention to them, even though that's what he was doing. And he got such a bad name toward the end of his career that when he was hanging out with Basquiat, Basquiat's career was kind of dragged down for a little period of time because he was very close to Andy Warhol. That's how bad a reputation Andy Warhol got. He became a parody of himself to people in the art world toward the end of his life.
Yeah, it was a much different scene than, I mean, he kind of, in a way, got 1980s, you know?
Yeah, I guess
He sort of mirrored what happened in the 1980s mm-hmm. with consumerism and just, you know, MTV came along. He did a couple of shows on MTV.
Very cool shows too.
One called Andy Warhol's TV and one called Andy Warhol's 15 Minutes. Yeah, they weren't that bad actually. But it was a different thing for sure. He, like you said, he sold out from the beginning, but I think everyone in his circle like thought he really sold out in the 80s, like, and not in a good way that he should be proud of, you know?
I think it just took the rest of the world like that long to catch on that he had always been a sellout and was totally fine with that and didn't care.
Maybe, yeah.
So this is his reputation in the art world. His star was still quite bright everywhere else. Like, he would be on TV. Like you said, he had two different MTV shows in the mid-80s. Like, he was hanging out with some of the great up-and-coming artists like Basquiat or Keith Haring. He was very well-known. He got work as much as he needed. And his last major work was pretty great. It was an interpretation of The Last Supper. Part of it is like a sales sticker that says $6.99. It's one of the more prominent things. And then another prominent thing, there's Jesus is on there too. And next to it, it says the big C.
Which I love. What does that even stand for?
I think Christ.
Christ, yeah, I guess?
The big C.
It could be anything, though, if you think about it.
It could be, but this is the Last Supper. So he was, again, not really revered in the art world until after his death, and it became very clear that, like, this guy was an artistic genius, not just in his art, but in his life, too. Like the time capsules is a good example of that.
Yeah, he, in 74, he started the Time Capsules Project. He filled up 569 cardboard boxes, a steamer trunk, 20 filing cabinets, and they're, you know, letters. They're bric-a-brac from his life. There's artwork. There's ticket stubs. There's clothing. All the way back from the 1950s for about close to 30 years worth of stuff in these time capsules.
Yeah, I saw he would just sweep his desk clean into a box like once every week or two and like write TC on it for Time Capsule.
Well, when you're that famous, that becomes hugely valuable. If I swept the stuff off of my desk, it's not worth anything.
So right. So you've got the time capsules, which is a really deep peek into his life. He also kept diaries, and Yumi brought this to my attention. She was super into Andy Warhol for a while, and she found out that he had been audited, Chuck, every year, by the IRS from 1972 until his death in 1987.
Yeah, thank you, Nixon.
Yeah, he attributed it to Nixon, revenge from Nixon, and that's actually probably a pretty good hypothesis because he had created political artwork for George McGovern's 1972 campaign, and it was like an ugly portrait of Nixon. Then underneath it said, "Vote McGovern." And it's entirely possible Nixon ordered him to be audited, and it just got kept up.
It's no coincidence. You don't get audited every year.
Sure.
That's not how it works.
So he would start noting everything, right?
Oh, I'm sure that he kept very good records from that point on.
He did. He would dictate his diary by phone every morning, and those became published later on as Andy Warhol's diaries. So there's a lot known about that guy, and yet he's still an enigma.
Yeah, very much. When I said earlier that he did not die, at least right away, from that gunshot, he would die from complications from that gunshot many years later. Mm-hmm. In February of 1987, he was 58 years old, complications of having his gallbladder removed. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, they can draw a direct line to that shooting and his eventual death. He left a treasure trove, like you said, of stuff. He donated everything, basically, to what is now the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts. It's worth a lot of money. They've given out close to $300 million just in grants to more than 1,000 art organizations over the year.
No.
And I think they are partnered with the Carnegie Institute and the DIA Art Foundation to build the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Which is where I last year saw Bonnie Prince Billy.
Oh, yeah.
Play one of my many shows that I've seen of his.
Right.
He played at the Andy Warhol Museum because
cool.
That's what he does. He plays at weird places like that. Or not weird, just different places. And it was great. And it was cool to walk around that museum a little bit beforehand. They have they have a lot of his work. They have more than 4,000 videotapes. And they got those time capsules there.
Yeah, every single one of them, I think, right?
I think so.
So in addition to predicting the 15 minutes of fame for the future, even if he didn't originally come up with it, he also had another idea that I think kind of came to fruition later on. He had an idea for a chain of diners that he called Andy Mats, and they were for people who eat alone, and you just sit at a table.
Aww.
They serve you frozen food, and then you watch TV by yourself, and that everyone has their own TV set.
Oh, interesting.
Basically just predicted smartphones in society today.
That's where we are now.
Yeah, for sure.
Never thought of that.
And then there's one other thing. If you are a fan of cringe, you don't like cringe, do you?
Like cringe comedy?
Basically, or cringe performance art.
I like stuff like The Office,
okay.
But it can border on, like, I don't want to watch this, for sure.
Yeah, I can't take it very easily. And mm-hmm. If you watch his interviews, they're very cringy. He would purposely just sit there and go, whatever.
Like that stuff, actually.
And he didn't have anything to say or couldn't think of what to say. Like, he would just be a terrible interviewee.
Yeah.
And then there's also Merv Griffin show segment with him and Edie Sedgwick. And mm-hmm. he just refuses to talk the whole time. And it's up to Edie Sedgwick to try to keep things going. And she's like 21 years old. It's just really hard to watch. I think I made it maybe a minute into it. And I was like, I can't watch this anymore.
I can actually watch that stuff. Yeah, I'm going to check that out.
Okay. You're going to love it.
I don't know how much I love it, but I don't know. Sometimes when someone is just, I think that it's having no regard for, and I'm not saying it's like it's cool to go in there and like wreck an interview, like I also think like, I don't know, if someone doesn't believe in that system and they think it's all BS to make a statement like that, is like, fine, as long as everyone's not doing it. No one wants to watch everybody do that.
Yeah, for sure. It's weird though, because he was enthralled by celebrity from a very young age, but he wouldn't participate in it when he was a celebrity himself, even
but
though
he, also loved
he wanted to be a celebrity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A conundrum.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's it for Andy Warhol, huh?
Yeah, this could have been two or three eps, but I think it's a pretty good overview.
I think so, too. If you want to know more about Andy Warhol, there, like you said, is a lot more to learn. And you can find stuff starting out on the internet and then go to Pittsburgh and see his stuff in person. And then save up $11 million and buy one of his paintings yourself.
That's right.
And while you're saving that money up, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this shortish in Swedish. Hey, guys. Actually, this is more than Swedish. This is great. Hey, guys. I'm an old retired concert pianist who remembers many Hammond organs from my youth. I didn't play them professionally. But listen to this, Josh. You're going to love this. I was the pianist for the Pittsburgh Symphony. And I was so interested, though, in the history of the Hammond. I had no idea. Had actually never even thought about their origin, although I played a few in funeral homes over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I played big pipe organs with stops, including for the Pittsburgh Symphony, but I never mastered those slide bars on the Hammond. It's interesting you did a whole podcast about Hammond organs, but I don't think we heard a single musical note. There was a wonderful young lady, Rhoda Scott, who used to play at the Hurricane Lounge in Pittsburgh. She's still living, also in her early 80s, like me. Thanks for a wonderful learning experience. And this, my friends, is from a legend, Patricia Prattis Jennings. And I did a little wormholing with Patricia. And it turns out Patricia is a legend. She played, I believe she was the first black woman to sign a major contract with a major symphony in the United States.
Nice.
There's a great, great YouTube piece on her. I can't remember. It's a Pittsburgh, a local Pittsburgh thing. But it's really good. And she's interviewed and she's just wonderful and amazing talent. And it just knocks me out that in her 80s, she's like getting something out of our show.
That is pretty cool. And that's a lot of range, too, going from the symphony to a funeral. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, totally. But she played for the symphony, Pittsburgh Symphony, for decades.
Right. But she could also play a funeral, too. I'm sure they're quite different. The whole
Absolutely.
Vibe's got to be different, you know?
I would think so.
And also, one more thing. I'll bet the Hurricane Lounge was the place to be.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Thanks a lot, Patricia. That is really cool. Thank you for writing in. And like Chuck said, thank you for getting something out of our episode. And if you want to be like Patricia, you can get in touch with us via email, too. Send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater.
In business, first impressions are everything. And that's why every business owner needs to know about Ruby. Ruby is the virtual receptionist company who screens, transfers, and takes messages 24/7, all while making your customers feel special. You definitely don't want to hire a subpar front desk person. And with Ruby, they engage with your callers in a conversational way, just like your best employee would. Never miss another customer call again. This year, make your business the best it can be. Visit ruby.com today. Or just call them at 844-900-RUBY.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.